George. And yeah, George wasn't wrong too much about Brian there. And I could actually start this out with a story that kind of sets up the rest of everything I'm going to say. This is a ridiculous talk, really silly. I'm 30 years old, all right? So most of the things I'm going to talk about happened before I was born or when I was too young to know any better. And so to have me volunteered to, I like history, like this talk about 6 months ago, well, that's this is what you're getting. You're getting a kid talking about the old days, in a certain sense. Well, yeah, Fred Bryan also has been a really cool person to talk to about a lot of stuff in the old days. And as much as he was mentioning that Brian was the kind of harbinger of the proprietary Unix, Bell's Unix, he was actually probably the biggest person bringing BSD to Murray Hill and Bell Labs back in the day. He was fighting pretty hardcore for it. All the developers wanted it, all the users wanted it, all these people wanted it, and their systems division wanted System 5. They wanted the System 5 so they could standardize all the divisions and kind of take control. They were making a good job for themselves. And so he actually fought a lot of that tooth and nail to keep BSD at on Murray Hill back in the day. So with that stated, look, I'm going to say a lot of things in this that the histories of it, depending on who you read in this, in the same book even, they differ. Who was there? Who was paying attention? Did someone write it down? Well, kind of. I wrote this email about it and found that. There's a lot of stories that don't match up. There's a lot of details that don't match up. And there's a lot of source code that we could all read way more than any of us will ever read. So with all that stated, there are going to be things that I'm going to say tonight that some of you will probably think are incorrect. And you may very well be right. And to be honest, that doesn't matter. That's not the gist of what I'm going to go for tonight. So, with that stated, I'm also probably going to say a bunch of things I was saying just a minute ago that are kind of contentious in certain respects. Could get me into trouble. I'm not a committer on any project, so I don't care. But, you know, for the sake of nice bug, for the sake of everybody, for the sake of not wanting to cause damage in the world, we all get to vote at the end of this as to whether or not this audio recording gets out somewhere, or if it's just not worth it, like put it out, nobody cares. All right. So with all of that stated, Ike context. Yeah, I love Unix. What is it? I ramble about jail. George covered all that. I talk about jails, and lately been talking about how they're a lot like the formulation of cities, apartment buildings, office buildings, that kind of thing. I get excited about thinking about things that way. So here's a warranty announcement, born in 76, historical talk. I'm a huge fan of classic Unix methodology, because Unix is more than just an OS. It's a way of working at this point. It's a process. And this lecture is definitely a messy hack. This is fun. This to me captures a lot of the fun of Unix, spirit of Unix, all these daemons running around in the machine. And this is from a Usenix t-shirt, I think 80-something, early 80s. Daemons. 1958, Oliver Selfridge. He wrote this paper where he referred to pandemonium from Milton's Paradise Lost. Right, because he was talking about how to build complex systems, and he was really attacking these kind of monolithic ideas about complex systems. They were, kind of Turing era talking about, like, we want to make a machine that recognizes human speech and can, respond to human input. It was this, like, wild problem that people were trying to solve in very big, single, complicated ways that he broke down into all these parts. Like, hey, what if somebody, just like the demons in Paradise Lost, what if you had one demon talking to a bunch of other demons that all recognized letters from words? And if A thinks it's certain A, it says, I heard it, and it tells the master demon, and the master demon, says, well, it's an A. And B says, I heard a B, and D says, well, I think it was a D. Then the master demon can decide, and you don't have the whole thing destroyed.
If it's Google.
The paper's a fun read, definitely. And there's also then Maxwell's Daemons, which I bring up for Mark, and people do think this had something to do with the history of the BSD Daemon. And I've just moved beyond it, because whatever. More people know about Maxwell's Daemon. And we have Beastie, which came about later, 1970s, early 70s, and when Cusick was working with some people at Lucasfilm, and got somebody who was an ex-Disney animator to actually draw the first Beastie guy for him, like, hey, we need a mascot. And there he is. And it's all chronicled on the Cusick site from that point on. So what is so great about Unix? Like, why are we all here? Why are we excited? What's kept it alive so long? What's, you know, this thing should be dead and gone by now, the way technology moves. let's look at, what is Unix, all right? Just breaking this down. This is stupid simple, all right? I'll try to move fast. It's a computer operating system. It's portable to various hardwares. It's also a standard. That was part of the original idea. And why are standards exciting? You know, we take this stuff for granted because there was a time when machine screws weren't standard. You know, you got a machine needed the screws that came from the machine shop that built the machine, because every machinist had a better pitch and ideas about the way that threads and screws should work, right? And this lost battles in World War I, especially some really noteworthy ones in North Africa that were really bizarre, where they just simply didn't have the right screws. At the end, I'm going to have lots of talk time. I promise. I just want to whip through this stuff.
If you have questions,
it
was more of a statement.
So, thing about standards, though, all right, we get Grace Hooper up here. The wonderful thing about standards is that there's so many of them to choose from. And she said that sometime in the 30s. And Grace Hooper, for those who don't know her, was responsible for things like COBOL, and was working for the RAND Corporation and helped work crack the Enigma machine during World War II. She's pretty cool. Interesting character. before Unix, operating systems were mostly theory, right? This was a neat idea, and especially this kind of idea of portability. People didn't quite get that yet. Machines were obviously built with software that ran that particular machine. I think, you know, with that light on, we can see everything. It's cool. So the operating systems were mostly theory, mainframes, and all of these systems. Like, every time a software engineer went to work for a different company or work on a new project, it's pretty much guaranteed they're going to have a completely different operating environment and have to learn a lot of stuff just to be able to get working. This was not a cool situation. People got sick of this stuff. And from a business perspective, businesses got worried about this stuff. Wow, how are we going to buy this big, you know, gazillion-dollar machine when in a few years, when we get a new one to replace it, we're going to have to rewrite everything from scratch and lose all our data? That goes into the history of databases. That goes into the history of databases. That goes into the history of the way IBM's thinking about business and selling more stuff, always selling more stuff. So IBM 360, hey, same instruction architecture, right? This was their kind of beginning contribution to this stuff. In 1960, CDC, University of Illinois, developed the Plato operating system, which is, in my opinion, that's a whole other thing. This is something that's really new to me, that I just discovered, and I swear to God, Plato is like, if computing is rock and roll, Plato is muddy waters. Like, Plato is kind of astounding. Everything you find on like an Apple iPhone was in Plato, this big mainframe-oriented system. Everything. It's really nifty. It was a commercial failure, Plato in 1961, remember this too, no multi-threading, no time sharing, no multiple users, one program ran at one time. So it was really exciting that two users at once could use the Plato system. time sharing, back in time a little bit, 57, Bob Berner described time sharing, right? And then a year later, John McCarthy implemented it with John Berner. And what is it, 1961, CTSS, compatible time sharing system, was born. BTSS, Dartmouth time sharing system, followed shortly after. And then what else with time sharing? 1966, here we go, Multics. This is Bell Labs, GE, and MIT all collaborating to make a time sharing operating system. Now, nobody at this point also was talking about it being portable and all these other things. That was all; those were all separate problems that we weren't willing to address at this point. They were just trying to nail time sharing. What is it? They really were trying to do something to move towards a standard. That language at the bottom, almost all the present and near future requirements of a large computer utility. That's from their design documents. They really were trying to come towards the standard so they could quit reinventing the wheel every other year. And Bell was really important in this. GE, based on how many computers, you know, we all have GE PCs at home, so they were wildly successful. This was, you know, Bell backed out of this project eventually. Who's Bell? What's Bell? Let me talk about this for a second. What's Bell? Bell Labs, Murray Hill, New Jersey. And over here on the left, that's Joseph G. Thompson, who kind of helped birth Bell Labs. He discovered the electron. The, you know, 1947, Bell gave us the transistor. 1969, charge coupled device. These are all things that we all have in this room. There's a camera on my phone. It's the birthplace of the cell phone. You know, among like a gazillion other things.
Is that a good thing?
Good question, actually. This was a research institution, and now today, some of us, like youngins like myself, this is a pretty cool idea. A research institution? Wait a minute, they did research there. Like, they just people got paid just to like hack stuff and make neat things and follow creative ideas. Well, didn't they have to do something for the business to make the telephone company work? No, they made a gigantic amount of money elsewhere. They were just, you know, it was a pride thing, it was a Cold War thing. If you wave your hand again, I'm going to reach out and knock you out the rest of the meeting. No. You know, so here we hit a point where, here we hit a point where we have a lot of really cool, raw, real research going on. This is different than now, all right? You go to a computing conference back in the 60s, and you'd have a bunch of guys from research institutions, a bunch of guys from the military, a bunch of guys from the from academic institutions of various types, which really could be bundled under research. And the work being done at academic institutions was that of like, hey, what's the next type of programming language? What's the next type of system we're going to build? Not like, here's how you write code in Java, or here's how you write code in a given, you know, framework of the world. Now go out and get a job, which is, you know, in certain ways very, very important. But if that's all you get from a computer science degree, that's grade school, and that's valuable. But that is, there's not a lot of people except, hey, everybody in this room who's doing a lot of interesting research. So you go to conferences nowadays, and who do you find? Well, the same damn people who were there then, except, you know, there's really nobody coming from any royal, raw research institutions in the world right now. And I see this as a real deficit. Anyways. Before Unix. And mind you, by the way, just because you hire a bunch of people from old research institutions and you create an arm of your group that makes wacky toys does not mean you're a research institution. Okay. So, and I'm not going to say anything more than that. Okay, so before Unix, you have, again, back to time sharing. So, Ken Thompson here. He liked games, and he had this game called Space Travel, And he rewrote Space Travel for Multics, and from what's kind of written, it kind of sucked. It really kind of sucked. It wasn't so great. And so suddenly, you know, here's Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie, the creators of the Unix. They had the legal department needed a better text editor, and they're the research guys. And I said, well, you know, maybe we'll write that, because if we do, we'll get some new machines because they'll pay us. But they needed that so that they could write patents faster and better, because the old type setting machines took them forever, and if they screwed something up, they had to start the document over. It was really tedious. So, you know, follow the money, and they were blessed with a PVP 11 machine, which actually was, you know, the equivalent of being handed a little 300 megahertz laptop today and saying, go to town. However, it only cost the legal department $65,000 for this thing. So they went to work writing Space Travel first and foremost, of course. And in the process, you know, wrote a. They also, when writing this text word processor, text editor, they hit this wall with it, and they really wanted to play Space Travel, focus on that. And thought, you know what? Let's write a portable operating system so that the next machine that the legal department gets, we don't have to rewrite the word processor, and we can make Space Travel better. And so we have this deck PDP-11. The first Unix used 16 kilobytes of memory and 8 kilobytes for additional applications. Again, far more power is in my pocket than that. I think I sent, you know, picture emails that are a magnitude of order larger. Cool. Okay, so we got the first Unix, and we have the first time sharing system, which gets described a few years later publicly, because whoa, Bell is huge. They're easily the largest corporation in the world. Their revenue represented 1% of the American gross domestic product at that time. The courts hit them with antitrust suits with all this stuff, and because all of these other businesses said, you know what, you guys are so big and you have such great research money to throw at things like this, that this is an unfair competitive advantage. Court said, you know, you just did this thing with computing, we're going to force you to give the source code to anybody who asks for it. And this was down the path, I won't get too much into Bell because that's kind of boring, but to the breakup of the Bell system. So they had to give the tapes to whomever requested it. And in the early days, the tapes came with this hand-signed note that said, love, Ken, tape to the tapes. And that's well documented. Here's the Unix time-sharing system paper from 1974, which does start out with, wow, at this point in the world, we know about 10 installations that are running Unix. This is really exciting. So they're presenting their time-sharing, multi-user operating system. This was freaky stuff. People flipped out over it. And it ran on all this DEC hardware at the time. There's a whole little thought about how porting it from DEC to DEC. You know, what had what, and all those details are really interesting and are nauseatingly boring at the same time, you know. And we all have hardware that we could talk at length about, don't we? That really, there's not many people who want to hear. So if you're interested more about that time period, there's lots of cool documentation about it. And, you know, Unix started spreading because they're handing the tapes out. And it became the developer's choice, because here you've got this thing. Think about this. You've got this thing that you can just get. And as an engineer or developer, you can keep that source code for the rest of your life. You own it as much as everybody else owned it. There's no, you know, developer program you have to pay into with DEC. There's no developer program that you pay into with IBM or anybody.
DEC's a developer program.
I know. That did have a developer program. You don't have to pay to be a part of something, or you don't have to be a part of someone else's program or regime. You can own this. You can create your own world. And this was really liberating to a lot of universities in the world, a lot of places where they really just needed to continue with more interesting thoughts. This was great for commercial purposes because businesses were now liberated to move forward with more complicated ideas and build on top of Unix. And hackers liked it at the end of the day. It was made by hackers. And if you didn't like something, wow, just rewrite it, make it better. That's pretty exciting. So, here's a better map, which have more pictures of. This is Levin as this really, really cool, big history of Unix map. And very quickly, we're already in 1970s and already gone crazy with all these various Unixes. And, the 80s brought us, I'll come back to this in the future here, but the 80s brought these crazy commercial Unix wars, which were nauseating and wonderful at the same time. Because, to quote Dennis Ritchie on this, the thing about the Unix wars, he said, it brought a lot of attention to Unix and got a lot of people exposed to it. So the nauseating commercialization and privatization of various strains of Unix, let's not get so excited about it. Just let it all go. In the 90s, we had .com and all the wild, the rise of the internet, and we have, here's the late 90s, and a bunch of things drop out there as the .bomb starts bombing, and we continue on into the 21st century, and there's still all this live and active Unix, so we're looking at, the oldest computing culture that is alive and moving forward and creating progress in computing in the world. This is really cool. This is really exciting stuff. And we get back all the way up to where we are about now, and things start boiling down and behind this, dropping off. There are a lot of things you can see that have lives and deaths. Some things get folded back into other things. Some things just stop because others succeed better. All the developers go there. All the ride share goes there. It depends. You have a very fluid environment of things moving apart and moving together. And, here we are at the latest printing of this. Here's the Levinas' page, by the way. You have the whole timeline. He has these funny, let's do this real quick. He has these great, we're going to all take a picture, grab a page of this. That's why I said wear a nice shirt today. So that we can put a geeky, nice bug picture up on Levin as a site, if you'll post it, of all of us holding this. Because why not? Because it's something to do. Alright, so we kind of get where this is gone. And here's the only Unixes that he's listed, which is listed on this paper as well. There's a lot of stuff that I can see is missing from this chart. There's a lot of Unixes and a lot of things in Unix that aren't there. So, this is a lot bigger than even this, one guy can really track very well. So let's talk about a couple other things real quick that came from Unix and Mel. And one of them is the C programming language. In the words of one of the authors of the language, for better and for worse, here we are, and it seems to be taking off. We have C coming out. This is my little actual core bibliography. I got a lot more books up here, but two books from about the same time period that intimately describe Unix almost exactly as it is to any of us who touched it today. Really exciting, really cool. And actually that old Unix time sharing paper, boy, some of the semantics are kind of funny and some of the scale of how much memory they're using and how much disk you're able to deal with and that kind of thing are kind of funny. But everything else is the same Unix we're using today. Simple, simple, simple modular rules. So now we get into the modular rules thing. We get into something else that's what is Unix beyond the source code? And let me quote some other people on this. A lot of people in open source have said this. This is Unix before anybody called it open source. Okay? Open source is a relatively new kind of market term. It was open source. We all took it. There was a MIT license, BSD license, all these things back in the day. But at the end of the day, like, nobody really cared. It was just there, like water or air or anything like it. And some people took that water, put it in bottles, and sold it to people, you know. But there's more to Unix than just the code, than just the stuff. There's also kind of ideology and ways of working that have made it, I feel, succeed over time. There's a lot of people who've written a lot of different things. Rob Pike has a 6-point list. I'm only going to show this one list. Eric Raymond has just a big list of what, you know, the spirit of Unix stuff and like what's really backing it.
These are the biggies. McElroy, another Bell guy, write programs that do one thing and do it well. Write programs that work together. Write programs to handle text streams, because that is a universal interface. All right, so that's like this weird mantra. And a lot of people just sum the whole thing up into write programs that do one thing and do it well. So you have, again, this going back to Arthur Selfridge, this idea of breaking up problems into lots of easily solvable problems. You have a really powerful system that suddenly people are able to do incredibly complex things with, because it's made out of small, simple components, each one of which can fail, and hopefully can fail gracefully, and if they fail, can be replaced or redesigned. And it's, you know, a continual growing evolutionary process instead of that of building and burning all the time. So I'm going through some of this stuff kind of quickly, because I do want to open this up to kind of bigger question stuff towards the end, and go over and kind of have some other rants to go through towards the end that don't have slides. So moving fast through time. This is the BSD users group. All right. So we all obviously in this room, somehow or another, we know what BSD is, and a lot of us think it's pretty bloody important stuff, pretty neat stuff. And there's reasons for it, because you have a history of, there's two really important BSDs that I think are in this history talk are important. And they were really quite close to each other. Bill Joy and Kirk Mckusick were at the old Berkeley Computer Science Research Group, and eventually were the guys who started the Berkeley software distribution of Unix. And they went through a number of phases with this, and they were competing against DEC's VAX operating system. And so VAX was, you know, of course, what you got with your DEC hardware. And
VAX was hardware. VMS was the operating system.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Humbly up here. VMS. Sorry. And VAX was one of the DEC hardwares. VMS was basically a rival operating system to Unix. And at a certain time, at this moment, DARPA was heavily involved with overhauling how the ARPANET worked. Because the ARPANET was limited to, in terms of addressing, 255 nodes up to this point. And so they were going to address changes. They were looking to do a number, DARPA was looking to do a number of things. They were an organization that was that was created by the U.S. military and the Pentagon to bring together all of the branches in the military and say, hey, you know, Navy, you guys are doing cool research on cryptography over here. Hey, Army, you're doing the same research, and you guys are double doing each other's work, and you're not sharing any notes, and both move faster if this stuff was shared. DARPA was created as this agency to kind of bring them all together and orchestrate R&D for the military. Which in the history of the world is always an active thing. With all of that stated, DARPA wanted to standardize what all of the branches of the military were using, because, you know, they had things that, well, simply put, the software wasn't portable between branches of the military and research divisions that were doing the same work. And so DARPA put out this big competition internally, and they settled on DEC hardware. Okay, everybody's going to use this breed of DEC hardware. And now we got to figure out which we're going to use. All the hackers, all the programmers, all the developers, all the systems, in all branches of the military, well, if we're going to go DEC, we want Unix. We want Unix bad. This didn't, the top brass didn't really like that. This Unix stuff, we don't know where this comes from. This comes from a bunch of long hairs at Berkeley, or what? Or a bunch of long hairs at Murray Hill. Like, we don't like any of what's going on with this. We're not comfortable with it. We like VAX. So the DARPA said, okay, to handle this, to resolve this problem, which doesn't sound like a problem that some of us have argued in our jobs day to day in the last 5 years maybe, suddenly DARPA internally makes, okay, we're going to make a competition. And we're going to pit VMS against BSD, Unix, and we're going to see which one wins. And the actual report, when it came down to it, was lame. By the time it landed on Bill Joy's desk, those were the actual like public stories come from, he flipped out. He was like, this is stupid. How can you base performance of an operating system on these stupid benchmarks? You can do this a million times in an hour, but we could only do it 500,000 times? Like, when is that reality? When is that, you know, this is a multi-user time-sharing operating system that has no bearing on real-world performance. This is minute. Anybody who's done any kind of benchmarking performance testing knows the kind of intricacies we're talking about here. And what happens when you have a real, active, live system with chaotic events going on. So Bill just said, okay, great. If that's the way it's going to be, if that these are the benchmarks they're going to judge everything on, we're going to beat them on every one of these bloody benchmarks, and that's all there is to it. So he and Kirk Cusick sit down, hack, 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 hack. They work through everything. So four dot oh A, right before this, was the rewrite that they beat VMS on just about everything. There's some other funny stories that Kirk tells, and if you ever go to Cusick's website, order his video, or if you're at a conference and you get it. It's worth it. It's a lot of fun. Like, we should actually have a showing of it, like as a drinking party sometime. Because it's, some month when we got to, meet to speak for the desert show. It's
supposed
something.
To be a jail meeting.
Yeah, we're supposed to be a jail meeting. We'll show that instead. The,
four times again.
The, So with that stated, they beat VMS, and all the hackers in the military rejoiced and said, "Yay, we get Unix, cool!" And that put a lot of grant money in Bill Joy's control in Berkeley and CSRG. That was a really good time to be at CSRG, not because it was flowing with money, but because it had little, and everybody could work on Unix. Straight up. So next thing that happened was they said, oh, okay, well, we're redoing the ARPANET, and we're redoing all these things, we have this TCP specification, and nobody's written a good stack for this yet that really exists yet. We've agreed on how TCP should work and have the specification out, and we have a private company, which do I mention the private company in the notes? It's mentioned somewhere. Oh, yeah, BBN. Here it is. The benchmarks. Okay, I'm sorry. The benchmarks became that performance whammy that got them on DARPA side was 4.1. 4.2 began the 4.1 series actually. This is actually incorrect. Wow. Okay, that's what you get for copying from somewhere. The 4.1 series, 4.1A, I believe. They started with a really bad naming convention because Bell didn't want them to use version 5 because it competed with then System 5 Unix. The marketing guys and the lawyers all raised their arms and all packers were, we don't even want to talk about it. We'll just name it 4.1. 4.1A incorporated the first TCP IP stack. And this was for this brand new stuff, this Ethernet. This was pretty exciting stuff. And so the way it worked is the military hired a private contractor to actually write the core of how TCP should run, and they said to the Unix group at Berkeley, hey, why don't you guys write all of the kind of user land, the frameworks the system calls, why don't you guys design out the higher level interfaces? And high level interface back then actually was system calls, And so BBNN was supposed to then write this core stuff. Well, so they go chugging along, and they finish the design of how the system calls for TCP should work pretty fast. And they're sitting twiddling their thumbs, wanting to play with it. And it's in the BBN, like, are you guys done? No, not yet, not yet. Are you guys done? No. So finally just wrote it themselves. And by the time BBN was done, they finished. And so suddenly there's two TCP stacks. And they ran exactly the same. And they ran at the same speed. They were pretty much identical. And so, you know, of course, DARPA wanted the BBNN stack. They paid for it. The guys in Berkeley said, no, that's stupid. We don't want to put in the BBNN stack. DARPA said, we paid for it. It's already done. Like, we want to take this. And in Berkeley, they said, yeah, really? Well, let me see. This stuff's running at about 56 kilobytes, which are the speed of our trunk lines cross country. But let's plug these Ethernet lines in. And hold on just a minute. And they ran back into the back, rewrote it again, and suddenly they had about 700 kilobytes of speed, and it was taking about half the system's CPU as opposed to all of the system's CPU. And DARPA went, oh, yeah, that's hot. And so did the rest of the world. And so 4.1A goes out the door with the Berkeley TCP code, which actually made a lot of people at DARPA really, the top brass guys, really, really angry, because suddenly now it's propagating through the rest of the world with the Berkeley code, not the BBNN code. Oh well, it was something nicer anyways. So that's 4.1. 4.2 release. There's a whole story, and Kurt Cusick is another one whose picture should be in these slides. I don't have many people's pictures. His should be, because, you know, since 78 to present day, he's an active and really valuable contributor to BSD Unix, which is kind of astounding. There's a lot of people who are still contributing from that time, but, you know, it kind of takes cake for being, like, the oldest really active developer. And as far as I'm concerned, an inspiration to knock down any myths of, like, hacker burnout, or you're too old to think, you know, to be able to go through and think about anything. That's something that's really not a part of BSD Unix and the Unix history, to be really honest. That's a weird, newfangled idea. This idea that a lot of us know about in work, I'm getting on a tangent here, but I was asked to speak, so I go on tangents. You know, with this stated, you know, there's this kind of idea that hackers burn out after a certain period of time. And, you know, you can't keep up with all the new languages, you can't keep up with blah, 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 blah. And this is kind of something, I don't know where this came from, maybe it came from something in the 90s, or the feverish excitement of the development of the PC and the idea of two guys in the garage changing the world kind of stuff. I don't know exactly where that all came from, but, you know, it's really not true, because here we have this thing that's still one of the more powerful software, how can I put it? It's undeniable that BSD is still running really critical stuff all over the world and continues to lead in a lot of various places in computing. Yet, a lot of the developers have been writing code for at least 10 years. We're working on a number of the BSD projects. And, you know, there's fistfuls of them who have been writing for more than 20 years. So, you know, like, this is all, like, pretty cool stuff. Like, there are things in computing that don't change. And this is what we see repeatedly in the history of looking at all of this as a developer, that, like, wow, these kinds of problems, there are some problems that are just really difficult to solve. And they don't go away if you write it in a different language. They don't go away if you write it in a lower level or a higher level language, or if you switch your operating system, or if you do whatever. Like, there's just some problems that...
What if you use XML?
Oh, man, I'm
not
punching
you. You know, you're really... Not only are you distracting the speaker, you're distracting me and everybody else here. So could you just shut the fuck up until the end of the talk?
Hey, yeah, thanks. So the... What was I going to say? So anyways, 4.2 BSD, here we have file systems. That's where I got was before this tangent. We have file systems, and the FAST file system was initially written by Kirk McCusick as a kind of a blackmail, because he got in trouble with his, something got screwed up with his school grant money, blah, 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 for his stuff. Bill Joy had this big DARPA grant, and he said, hey, Bill, for the summer, I'm screwed. Can I just get some of that DARPA money? And I'm going to, of course, continue to work on my thesis. I'm not going to really do anything for you. But can you, like, hook me up? Because, you know, I'm in trouble. And Bill said, yeah, but can you do one thing for me? Can you prototype out my file system design that I wrote up? And Kirk says, oh, yeah, well, sure. So what do you know? By fall, he's got this prototype of in userland of what is eventually becomes UFS, FAST file system. And then Bill Joy says, wow, this is a great prototype in userland. Can you now put it in the kernel? Oh, okay, yeah, sure. He ends up taking the next 18 months to put it in the kernel. And it says, oh yeah, and by the way, before we release this in the kernel, we have to have file system consistency check, FISC, we have to have dump, and we have to have restore. Those are all important utilities that we need for the file system. And Kirk at this point is going, oh man, so my summer money is, wow, you're really getting a lot of mileage out of this, Bill. And, and here we are, 30 years later, and McCusick's, core work is still Berkeley FAST file system, UFS2 at this point, he's still not finished. He said that, not me. That's kind of the biggest change to 4.2 BSD, because a lot of us in the room know Berkeley FAST file system radically changed and inspired pretty much every file system design, anything that writes persistent data from that point forward, including a lot of database design through the 80s and 90s. Fundamentally, that was kind of, I love that stuff, because this wasn't some concerted effort to write the best file system in the world or to do something. It was one of these moments when somebody was, given this freedom to do something creative and to, ostensibly given the freedom to fail as well, because if you came fall and this file system design sucked, well, it didn't really matter. You just needed to kind of work through the summer and do something. There's a lot of that in history. There's a lot of stuff like that. But, the best intentions can end everybody up with bupkis, quickly in the 80s, this is the only slide Usenix gets, and that's really a shame, because they've been an incredible organization. They're, Nicebug wouldn't really have a format if it weren't for Usenix, to really put it that way. Like, they were the central place for all the Unix actors to come together at one point in time, and that was the place to come together, Usenix conferences, and people submitting papers, doing things together, and it was where all the hackers ended up meeting and sitting down hacking all kinds of things out. It's where all kinds of great ideas went all around the world and all across the country. Usenix, at this point, they don't have the kind of presence that they did. Why? Was it because Usenix sucks? No, not at all. It's because at this point, we have so many more developers in the world running and developing Unix, it's impossible for any one organization to actually step into it and become some central hub, right? So Usenix may not be the organization that it once was, but they are really still an incredible organization for everybody to be around, whether you're a member of Usenix, whether you're outside of Usenix, whether you know somebody who said it once. Like, they affect how all of us live our lives and do our jobs every day. And out of Usenix came format for conferences that we all go to, came format for how people, all these researchers, military guys, academics, all of these individuals, they ended up drinking together, and that was pretty important to the development of Unix. So, you know, you have the history of, you know, the Wizards parties where everybody's after the conference, you know, having raging crazy parties. Like, that kind of stuff's important. Living life and having fun and, you know, like, basically what I'm getting at is that there is a wide array of individuals that it takes to make Unix successful. And this goes back to 69, when the long hairs were hanging out. And actually, to be fair, from what I understand, Dennis Ritchie is kind of a Air Force kind of dude in terms of his stature and his past. He's a whole other generation and was an older, he was one of the older ones back in 69. It takes everybody, right? So the freaky purple-haired mohawk kid with lots of piercings today. Boy, I've been to conferences and seen that mohawk purple-haired kid have just as much to say as some guy who's actually in the Air Force today doing something. You know, and that's really the spirit of what makes Unix great. You know, everybody's objectives and agendas working together. And everybody stealing from each other's energy and their objectives and agendas. And then the users, the attitude of the users. This is a great one. So that's Brian Redman. And he, you know, he was a bell cord, and up there it says, you know, he wrote a lot of things. He wrote, he was part of writing Honey Danberg, which was the reliable replacement for UUCP. And what is the quote? The quote is, "We don't want a user-friendly system," in quotes. "We are not friendly users, and neither are our colleagues. We are inconsiderate ogres without the slightest regard for the machine. We expect it to respond on command, to work endlessly and not put up a fuss, rather like a mute slave whose purpose is to silently obey." All right, so, yeah, this is the attitude of, you know, a lot of the Unix users. Another one that Brian Kernighan said once was, yeah, Unix, people complain that there's a lack of instrumentation on the dashboard, but anybody who really races cars know that you know a lot more about what's going on with the engine by listening. And it, you know, that's the kind of, that's a certain kind of attitude here, like, we want to race. We want to play space travel. So here's some more Unix big points. I'm going to take the 80s in one slide, all right, because now we're heading into territory that all of us are a lot closer to in one way or another, because some of these characters are still really actively involved in parts of our lives and projects we're around, or, you know, some of us in the room have been right there. So I have a lot less to say about it, actually, as it gets. It's easier to say stuff about, you know, from before I was born, actually, because, well, nobody can really argue too hard with me, except Mark. and so, you know, Unix big points. We have, you know, the emergence of the new project, Richard Stallman, MIT of the 80s, and moving on towards the Free Software Foundation. We have, you know, oh yeah, the 80s, that's the line for the 80s there. Linux, Linus Torvalds, 1991. We have the rise of open source software through the Unix Wars. We have the rise of the internet, and we have some fun slides real quick to show an event of scale that don't have much to do with internet, with Unix, but have actually a lot to do with the dot-com era, and then, you know, well, we have the two centers, and I was complaining earlier when I was talking about research labs, like, wow, where's the research labs? This is really a bad situation for the world to be in. We don't have any real research anywhere. Well, yeah, it kind of is and it kind of isn't, because, you know, we also have a situation where a guy like me can teach himself Unix by picking up, and this is how I taught myself Unix in the 90s, by picking up machines on the street in New York City, because, you know, especially in this neighborhood, boy, there's a lot of computers on the street at night. Picking up machines off the street, going home and hacking, enjoying it, you know, and like playing. You know, it doesn't, as long as you can get your rent paid, boy, that's a pretty cool research environment to be in. You know, so there's a kind of a balance now to, like, well, we don't have the research environments, but we have other, the world's different now. You know, maybe we will have real research groups sometime in the future again, but, you know, there's really never any reason to whine or complain about anything in Unix. I mean, just do it. Run it. Hack it. Have fun with it. let me get some BSD big points. I don't really need to get, pull the timeline up, I don't need to get into the history of Linux. It's real short so far, really, compared to all of this. But some BSD big points that I'll give us. The BSD users group, 386 BSD. This is when Unix came really off of mainframes and hit the Intel platform. Like, this was the convergence of the PC world, which was pretty separate from the Unix world for the entire, you know, until really the early 90s. And you have suddenly, wow, Unix is running on a PC. This is cool. You have NetBSD, which then is, of course, fork. The first real fork off of 386 BSD. 3BSD ends up being a continuation from 3BSD and then 4.1 BSD, and 4.1 being all the way back to the 80s, right? There wasn't a lot of change, amazingly enough, from the early 80s to the early 90s in BSD source. There weren't any major dock releases. That's pretty, and that was a lot of what was going on in Unix. There were a gazillion commercial Unixes going crazy all over the place, and it just chugged along, and it's still alive. It's really alive. And then 4.1 BSD, we of course had the BSDI license wars, which predate the recent, in recent memory, we all have SCO in our minds for Linux, suing Linux, trying to, or suing users of Linux for these lines of proprietary code that are in there. Oh, this, yeah, then they're done that with BSDs as well. You know, like we did that in the early 90s. And, you know, when they found the offending lines, and after, you know, this, it's a long story, the court case, but at the end of the day, the stuff that was offending was ripped out, and it really wasn't that offensive, said the courts, and everybody moved on. It sure spooked businesses for a while, though. And then we have OpenBSD, which is in mid-late 90s. Anybody got a year on that?
96?
Okay. OpenBSD, which is a fork of, It's a fork of NetBSD. And you know what's really funny is that Theo Durat, the leader of the OpenBSD project, was one of the four forkers and leaders of the NetBSD project, too. And I think a lot of us in this room are pretty darn glad that that guy's,
Difficult
to work with and likes to walk away with the source code. Because, boy, some amazing things have happened because of it that we all benefit from, no matter, even if you don't use Linux. So scale, future, okay. Let's look at networks. This is what little fun, like, abstract jump through some time here. Here we have 1969 ARPANET. Wow, that's a network diagram. I think most of us, most of our offices are maybe more complicated than that. This one's when? This one I don't remember. Oh, this is the late 60s ARPANET. This is 1977 ARPANET. This is Usenet, 1984. This is the beginning of, can you see that slide? Oh, that looks great up there. This is, you know, the IPv4 internet in the year 2000. That's, it's really, really a cool map when you look at it. This is like the Mieta Corporation or something. They make maps that charge for them, but they have some pictures on their site. They're gorgeous. They're worth looking at. And we'll crash a PDF viewer because they're just dense. And this is another one from the Oppy project. Thank you, Dan Kaminsky. Super rockin'. I mean, I love these maps. And this is the internet, and this is kind of a picture of what it looks like today. I mean, it looks really bad on that screen right now. It's really astounding to see a sixth of the world's population using computers that connect to the internet. Those are the stats right now. Looks like stuff like cities to me, which I like talking about. And cities. I love cities. This is a guy totally unrelated to Unix, kind of. His name's Stuart Brand. He's in like an urban design theorist kind of dude. He was part of starting the Whole Earth Catalog back in the day. Interesting guy. Design people love him to death. He does lots of cool stuff. World population and then urban and rural population numbers he's really fixated on. And, you know, we have 1800, the
world's population that was urban was 3%. 1900, 100 years later, 14%. And at this moment, it was 2005, I thought, when we hit 50% of the world's population in areas that we would call urban. So this really wild, fast growth towards urban life in the world, which to me, again, makes me think about the internet and how fast it's grown, mostly, you know, using BSD TCP stack that I mentioned earlier. Wow, so 1995, you can barely even see, this is world population versus internet users. It doesn't show up on the graph. 1995, it was about 20,000 internet users. Sounds wild because we're supposed to be .com, whatever, but, you know, don't believe the hype, man. That was what it was, and that was exciting. You know, and then, oh, and then, what is it? 304 million in 2000, and 2005, it was 938 million, and at this moment, I believe it's 1.4 billion, or the last sets of numbers that I saw. Those are all disputable. You can talk ad nauseum about what's right and what that means, and does that mean internet hosts, or is that, you know, users connecting with their, you know, valid account? It's kind of irrelevant. It's like taking world population status numbers. We don't know how many kids were born in the last 5 minutes, really. You know? So the rough numbers are okay with me. So, I mean, that's what that graph of growth looks like from the ARPANET to 2005. That's pretty cool. That's really exciting. So this makes it incredibly hard to talk about Unix history in the last 5 or 6 years because we have a lot of it. It's all really good stuff. There have been a lot of really amazing developments, and now we have workings of cultures of software that hardly know anything about what the internals of the other looks like. That's exciting. That's really interesting stuff. So, NET helps Unix grow, blah, blah, blah. Does anybody have anything that they think, let me see if I'm almost near the end of this whole talk, as I'm sliding through the Levinas timeline again. And towards the end of this talk, I want to leave that around. Yeah, this is really the end of the talk. You know, special thanks to Ken and Dennis and then Bert, who helped this talk out a lot by talking to me about a lot of different funny things. And of course, thanks to Nice Bug and everybody else and everything else that makes it possible to be in this room tonight. And mostly to all of you for being here. Thanks. But so with the timeline up, does anybody? Wow, I have one really. Is everybody bored out of their mind? Do you want to hear one more? You're bored out of your mind. Is anybody really bored out of their mind? I have one more funny story about Unix history and what you want to read when you're looking, or what I think you should be looking at when you're reading Unix history. So there's moments where Kirk Cusick is talking about DEX support for Unix at the time. And he was involved with Dennis Ritchie trying to get DEC to actually support systems that their claim was that, you know, DEC repair techs would come out to support the DEC hardware, the VAXes. This was the VAX era. And if it was running BSD Unix or just, you know, even System 5 Unix, any Unix of the day, they wouldn't support it. They wouldn't touch it. And this, you know, this was really frustrating. Like, wow, you've got a hardware problem with the disk. Well, it's not running VMS, so, you know, it's your problem. And no, it's a hardware problem. So they worked really hard with DEC and got Dennis Ritchie involved and all these people to try and get DEC. Like, don't you get it? You'll sell more hardware if you don't act like jerks about this. Because how can we even, you know, it's got a bad disk. We can't even find out what's wrong with the disk because it doesn't have VAX on it. You jerks. They were very frustrated. And DEC just held a hard line, VMS, VMS, VMS. And that was the Berkeley take on it. And eventually, Ritchie shrugged his shoulders and all went off and wrote all these disk utilities and other utilities themselves that ended up being very much better than what DEC was actually offering for the repair utilities. So they would, you know, service to the tech would come out and look and say, wow, these tools do stuff that our tools don't even come close to. And all the Berkeley guys smugly smile.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, that's an actual Kirk McCusick story, which I believe coming from Berkeley. And then, you know, I was talking to Brian from my slide about a similar story. I don't want to indict Brian. And, you know, he brought a lot of BSD Berkeley Unix to Bell Labs. And that was, you know, all the researchers, that's what I was their preferred Unix. They didn't want to run the Bell Unix. And the, so he said, that's crazy. We have no such problems at Bell. He said, you know, I actually remember a situation where we had two VAXs hooked together with, at that time, serial ports were a new interface to hook up your console. And we had two VAXs hooked together over the serial port that were doing early multiprocessing, and we actually modified some of the hardware pretty considerably to be running these multiprocessor VAXs. It was in the research division, and it was a preferred machine for all of us because it was, well, it was cool. It worked, and we got it to work. And he said, boy, you know, we had DEC guys come out, and they officially supported us when we were running BSD Unix on this multiprocessor dual VAX machine system, and the DEC guys were actually just tickled to come out and fix it when we broke something that they could fix. I don't get it. I don't know what that story comes from. So I look at this and I'm like, wow, who's telling the truth? How does this go? It's just like a lot of stuff that happens in the world today. Shrug your shoulders. You know, somebody over here, they got Intel to do this for them, but somebody over here didn't. You know, like, you've got to take this big world we live in with a little bit of a grain of salt and not get too upset when... This is my attitude. Not get too upset when XYZ hardware manufacturer isn't paying attention to you. Because, well, realistically, you may not be talking to the right people, the right part of the country. You might just not get along. They might not get along. There might be a lot of issues at hand. And so getting too worked up over some issues is really stupid. And because at the end of the day, you know, you have the opportunity to rewrite the utilities and do it better than anyone else that actually lead. So again, you know, for me, the kind of stuff that I like taking out of history, and even these stories that don't quite match up about debt support in this case, are that, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about just doing your work and continuing hacking. I hope that this lecture hasn't, you know, this has been a lecture that's taken a little bit of time and kept all our hands off of the keyboard and off of hacking. And I'm going to open up to questions for anybody who wants to ask them, but I really want to thank you guys, for everybody, for listening. And one other thing, the bibliography, I was joking around about the two books, but those really are all the books you need. I got a whole bunch of books up here. They're all mine, I've marked them. And they have RFID chips in them, and I'll find you in the city and steal any of them and kill you. But you could buy this whole stack of books right now, your e-books or Adol or Amazon.com in the use section. You could probably get the whole stack if you spend about a week trying for less than $50.
Not sure. Is there a referral program?
Say what? Well, the thing is that none of these books are in print, and this is one thing I wanted to bring up. I don't think any of these books are at all. Well, yeah. Okay. So this one is in print.
Yeah, it's the Art of Unix program is in print.
The really important ones are definitely not in print. And the really important ones were never put into print in paperback. And they cost a lot of money. And I personally am dying for the day the TCPIP books get paperback, because I've wanted those for years, the Addison Wesley set. And, you know, I can't afford $200 for I'm a guy who, you know, who's at home, taught myself Unix with machines off the street. I got a job, I pay my rent, but wow, $300 for a set of books is tough to swallow sometimes. So these are exciting for all of us, because the used books are really cheap and easy to find at this point. Really easy to find. Because all the publishers and everybody's attitudes and technology are new. Because there's a lot of books that get written about technology that rot in about 6 months. Got a short shelf life.
It's a lot of technology that comes and goes. And all these classics, it's amazing, are so incredibly relevant, it will blow anybody's mind. And so the, you know, if you want to learn C and you want to start actually writing core operating system stuff for any of the BSDs, this skinny little C book is your launch pad. And that's it. And that is for real. And there's a lot more to it than that, but that's the path of actually writing software. And it's not, you know, it makes higher level languages. If you come from a background like I did, actually, writing a lot, you know, back in the day, Perl, and then Python, doing all this other higher level stuff, it's not rocket science the way it's presented in these older texts. All right, this stuff, that's the whole point. If it's really good, it shouldn't be that hard to get moving with it. So these books, buy them and scream at vendors who write them to republish them in paperback. Because it's a really, you know, O'Reilly's done a great thing. O'Reilly's done an incredibly great thing by printing a lot of paperback books for all of us, right? And a lot of cheap books. They're not expensive. They crank them out. There's a lot of great titles. However, you know, there's a lot of stuff that they've put out that's rotted, and I really appreciate supporting new authors and new technical writers. But any of those writers, boy, some of us know some of those people in the room, and they'll tell you real fast how little money is involved with being a writer of a technical book. So you know, at the end of the day, it's really disappointing that people like Addison Wesley don't even bring these old texts to conferences, you know, when they still have them sitting in warehouses. So, you know, if you like the kind of attitude of this talk, or and you're not going to throw rotten fruit at me in a second, pester people about these books and get them, grab them, and come up here and look at all of them, because it's, you know, it's core to everything that we do and use today. And that's it. Thank you.